So we're going to take a look at a sugya that everybody knows. I mentioned to colleagues and to other students that in our Beit Midrash at Yule Girls, we had taken a break from Masechet Bava Kamma to do the sugya of Chanukah, and everybody rolled their eyes and said, "Oh, that again." When I told them which sugya we started with, they said, "Oh, of course, that's what everybody starts with." So let's take a look at it, because it's not as simple as it seems. And it's all on page one, the whole material we're going to look at. Just a couple of notes here. Is the material on Masechet Chanukah is nearly all found in the context of three or four pages of Talmud in Masechet Shabbat. And one could ask, and one should ask, why is it Masechet Shabbat? Where should it be? It should be in Masechet Chanukah, or Masechet Orot, you might want to call it. And the answer is because there is no Masechet Chanukah. There is not even a single Mishnah devoted to Chanukah. A single Mishnah, not just a chapter. There is not even a single Mishnah devoted to Chanukah. When I say Chanukah, chiefly what I mean is Ner Chanukah, because there's really nothing else to Chanukah that's unique. There's, of course, Hallel. But Hallel is not unique to Chanukah. Interestingly, as a side note, in Rambam's Mishneh Torah, and one of my Talmidot wrote an article about this that's going to get published in the next few days in our Beit Midrash Journal. Yes, I'm proud. The Rambam included the laws of Chanukah, the laws of Hallel, Dafka, and Chanukah. In other words, Chanukah is two chapters in the Rambam, one of them is Hallel. All the laws of Hallel, from any time we say Hallel, is Dafka and Chanukah. Now, one could argue that the reason he did that is because there's nothing else talking about on Chanukah, and so he, you know, put it in there. Rav Soloveitchik has a different take, in which he maintains that the essence of Chanukah is Hallel, and therefore the Rambam put it in there to kind of underscore that idea. But there is not a single Mishnah about devoted to the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah, and Ner Chanukah is actually only mentioned as an aside. Chanukah is mentioned in the Mishnah. In several places, but usually as either in Megillah as what we lay in on Chanukah, or how many aliyot there on Chanukah, in Masechet Bikurim as a time of year, you can bring Bikurim up until Chanukah, but not as the mitzvah itself. It's mentioned really tangentially in an odd place, and that is in Bava Kamma, the end of the sixth parak, the last mission of the sixth parak. Which talks about Nizkei Esh, the damage caused by fire. Talks about what happens if a smith is working in his forge in his store, and a spark shoots out, and there happens to be an animal carrying a load of flammable material in the marketplace, and it catches on, then the smith is liable. But if on the other hand, the animal's load is so big that it goes into the store and it catches on his lamp, then the animal owner is liable. But if the storekeeper put his lamp outside, then he's liable. And Rabbi Yehuda turns around and says, if it was Ner Chanukah, he's patur. That's it. That's all. So a lot of people have weighed in on the question of why there is no Masechet Chanukah and why there are no Mishnayot really devoted to Chanukah. The answer that Chanukah is rabbinic holiday doesn't answer anything, because there's Masechet Tanit, there's Masechet Moed Katan, according to the opinion that Chol HaMoed is an Isur D'Rabbanan of Malacha, and of course there's Masechet Megillah about Purim, and so the fact that it's a rabbinic holiday doesn't really wash. One of the common explanations is that during the period of the formation of the Mishnah, we were at a real low when it came to autonomy and military prowess, which we didn't have at all, and therefore highlighting Chanukah was kind of uncomfortable. And the reality is that Chanukah itself may have been something of a source of tension between the rabbis and the people, and Chanukah may have been much more of a grassroots holiday than a rabbinically favored holiday for a while. That's possible. The other possibility is one that the Chatam Sofer suggested. I would never say this on my own, but, you know, to quote the Chatam Sofer, I'm pretty safe ground, that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, who was the compiler of the Mishnah, was uncomfortable with the story of Chanukah, because the heroes of Chanukah, of course, are Chashmonaim, And Choshmerayim are cousins of Rav Avraham over here, the Kohanim. And the fact that they're Kohanim and fought, that's fine. But the fact that they're Kohanim and then put on the crown of royalty became a very big problem. And if you're interested, take a look at the Ramban in his commentary on Bereshit Memtet Pasuk Yod about Yehuda's role. And indeed, he says the reason the Choshmerayim, within 100 years or so, lost any semblance of power, really, 130 years, is because they violated Yaakov's dictate of Yehuda being the king and them taking that from him. But in any case, there are a number of rabbinic passages relating to Chanukah, of the laws of Chanukah, and so the editors of the Gemara collected them and put them into Masachet Shabbat. Why are they in Masachet Shabbat? There's actually a very simple reason. Is that the second chapter of Masachet Shabbat, which we're all familiar with, Bamim Adlikin, is devoted to the mitzvah of Ner Shabbat. And Ner Shabbat has all sorts of parameters, which is when you light it, more directly, what materials can be used, what sort of wicks, what sort of oils can be used. And as a result of that, it devolves into a discussion about whether the same restrictions apply to Chanukah. And that's sort of the beginning of the sugya. So you say we have a list of required wicks and oils for Shabbat, which have to be burning well and have to have a decent smell. They can't be fetid and they can't be sparking, right? Because the idea is to bring good, solid, reliable light into the house for Shabbat so you don't spill stuff and have a good time. So the question is whether the same restrictions apply to Chanukah. And then that spins off and then all the Chanukah material is assembled. But we're going to take a look at three brightot here, really. And remember, brightot, and this is central to what we're going to discuss, brightot are halachic passages, usually halachic passages, but passages that were composed by the same schools that ended up composing the Mishnah, meaning we had a bunch of halachot, thousands and thousands of halachot, and then when Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi compiled the Mishnah, he selected and rejected. And the rejected ones are brightot. Brightot just means outsider. So that which was not part of the canon but were maintained by the students of those schools and their memorizers. So they were kept alive, but there are several selections that we have of brightot in other places. And a brightot is often introduced with either the word Tanya or Tanu Rabbanan. So we have a Tanu Rabbanan here. We have two of them. We actually have three of them. So we're going to really like take a look at them and along the way ask a couple questions. I'll just ask you in the meantime not to turn the page over. Okay, Tanu Rabbanan. That worked, okay. Tanu Rabbanan. So, mitzvat Chanukah, ner ish uveito. So, what does that mean? Mitzvah of Chanukah is one candle per household. That's it. Which means that last night you put one candle out, tonight you put one candle out, the next night one candle out, and the whole holiday cost you eight candles. And candle's really not the right term, we'll call it a nair, but what we mean is some sort of a holder and some sort of a fuel, an oil, and a wick. Right? And the whole holiday will cost you eight of those. Really, you could use the same wick, just eight cups of oil. Right? And that would be regardless of how many people you have in the house. V'ham mehadrin, what does that mean, ham mehadrin? Which, by the way, is a phrase that shows up nowhere else in rabbinic literature than here. That's important to know. All right, it does show up on many, many packages of hot dogs. But what?
Those who want to
enhance. From what word? What's the source? Hadar, which is beauty. So lehader is to beautify. And by the way, in modern Hebrew, we would say that, right? Ani rotze lehader et ha mitzvah. I want to beautify the mitzvah. Hidur mitzvah, we're familiar with. And so mahadrin, the beautifiers, we'll call them. Ner lechol achad v'achad. What do they do? What do they do?
No question.
What do they do?
Life free.
They have a nair for each person. Now, at this point, we're going to ask the question, what does that mean? Does that mean that if my father is one of the mahadrin, then that means he gives me a nair too and I light it? Or does that mean that my father lights the amount of people in the house that many nairot, akin to the custom that many women have of lighting nairot Shabbat per as many people as they have in the family? Like we have seven that my wife lights every Friday, right? Seven, right, for the people in the family. So what does it mean? Does it mean that the person lighting lights that many, or does each person lights? That actually turns out to be a machloket about how to understand this. Yeah, what's the question?
Does
the Mehadrin term that we associate with Etrog, is that?
Nowhere in Shas. No. Okay. V'hamadrin min ha-mehadrin, and this is really odd, because remember, mitzvah Chanukah is a mitzvah d'Rabbanan. Right? It's very important, but it's a mitzvah d'Rabbanan. It's a rabbinic mitzvah. There is no other place anywhere in the literature that tells us this is the way to do a mitzvah, and this is the better way to do a mitzvah. Right? There is such a phrase as mitzvah min ha-muvchar, but that just sort of speaks about the quality of the act or the quality of the object, not about some sort of quantity piece. And so to say that people who want to do it even nicer add more, and here's the system by which they add more, is unmatched. To Mehadrin, Mehadrin exists nowhere. Right? There's no such thing elsewhere besides here. HaMehadrin, Min HaMehadrin, and then it gets even weirder. Because we are familiar with Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. Everybody, it's in our mother's milk. We know Beit Shammai, Beit Hillel, and we also come up with all sorts of stereotypes about them. That Beit Shammai were not nice, and Beit Hillel were nice, and Beit Shammai is always strict. I mean, none of that stuff is true. I mean, it's inaccurate, and it's an overgeneralization. But we're familiar with Machloket Beit Shammai, Beit Hillel, and then there are dozens, if not hundreds, of disputes between Beit Shammai, Beit Hillel. However, the disputes between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel are always about essential halacha. Besides some famous machlokot they had about ideals and stuff, right? About essential halacha, meaning what is the breaking point in this particular mitzvah? What is the sine qua non in this particular mitzvah? What's demanded here? In what way are you yotze? Is this a kosher sukkah or not a kosher sukkah? Right? The famous machlokot Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel about sukkah, where only you and part of you can fit in, and your table's in the house. Right? And here we have the essential, the basic mitzvah. We have the mehadrin, which again is kind of weird. And then we have mehadrin min ha-mehadrin, and here we have a machloket, which is just the bizarreness of this just continues to grow. And what's the mehadrin min ha-mehadrin? Beit Shammai omrim yom rishon madlik shmona mikan v'elach pochet v'olech. Everybody's familiar with this. Beit Shammai says you start with 8, and then you go down till the last night you have 1. And Beit Hillel omrim yom rishon madlik achat mikan v'elach mosif v'holech. And that's the Braita. Now, just a little bit of methodology here. We're reading a Braita. The Braita is in Hebrew. And the Braita uses names of people you're familiar with. You notice that immediately afterwards, the language switches to Aramaic. So, okay, Alex, I'll take rabbinic literature for 200. Okay? And the Jeopardy answer is, this is the language of the Talmud. Right? Go ahead. We'll get you $200. What's the answer? Aramaic. I fooled you. It's not Aramaic. Our answer. It's again his question. What is Aramaic, right? Well, if the judges knew their stuff, they would say, Ern. Right? Because the language of the Talmud is not Aramaic. What's the language of the Talmud? It's both. I want you to think what happens when you walk into any Judaic classroom in a day school of people where people have some background in learning. What language are you hearing? You're hearing three languages. If you're hearing, let's say, a Chumash class, you're hearing two languages. You're hearing Ivrit. When are you hearing Ivrit? When they're quoting Psukim. And you're hearing English, which is when they're discussing the Psukim. If you're in a, or it could be Yiddish, right, some local language, could be Farsi, but whatever the local language is. But you have a prime text that's in Hebrew, always Hebrew, by the way, and then you have a discussion, which is in whatever local language you have. Now, if your prime text is Gemara, you have three languages, which is Hebrew, some Aramaic, we'll talk about where that comes from, and English, Yiddish, Farsi, French, Spanish, whatever you're talking in among the people. And along with a couple Latin words or Greek words and Persian words that got into the Gemara anyways. What is that about? You have to remember that the Gemara is not a composition. The Gemara is a transcript of discussions that took place in the Batei Midrash in Bavel. In Bavel, they spoke Aramaic. They spoke Babylonian Aramaic. And Aramaic was the language that all these Chachamim used. Rabbi Akiva spoke Aramaic at home. All right, and Rav spoke Aramaic, and they all spoke Aramaic. But whenever they formulated legal dicta, legal statements, it was always in Hebrew. Hebrew is the language of the law. So every Mishnah that you encounter, with very few exceptions, will be in Hebrew. I don't mean that there aren't technical words thrown in. There are. There'll be Greek words that are used, legal terms like apotropos, but the essential language of the Mishnah, the essential language of a Braita, the essential language of a Maimra will always be in Hebrew. But the discussion is whatever language. So if somebody were listening to us, they'd hear a primary text discussed. I just read in Hebrew, and then we're here speaking in English. So the transcript would be in Hebrew and English. I remember the first time I saw somebody do this, when I came to the Rav's Shir, because when I was in Shir in Yeshiva, I would take notes in Hebrew, because it was a lot easier. I came, and there was every year in the Rav's Shir, there was a guy who was the note taker. It was his job. And then people would Xerox, in the early days of Xerox, and they'd Xerox the notes, and coming after the close of the final, get a stack like this. Yossi Adlerich was the note taker, and the notes were very funny because they went like this, because people would be writing in English and then throw in a whole phrase from the Gemara. They were back and forth. But if you think about it, that's no different than what the Gemara is. So one clue is, how do I know that I'm done with the Mishnah or done with the Braita? It switches to Aramaic because now I'm hearing the discussion. So now we have the discussion about it, and I'm not going to belabor it because I'll just to cut to the next Braita. The discussion about it is that there is actually a machloket about the machloket. How fun is that? But Hillel and Beit Shammai disagree about how to super beautify the mitzvah, up or down. And then we have two opinions in Eretz Yisrael about what Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai were disagreeing about. Are they disagreeing about what, whether it's better to let people know how many days are left or how many days have gone by? Or are they disagreeing about which components of the Beit HaMikdash to commemorate the specific component of Sukkot, where the korbanot would diminish every day, or the general approach of the Beit HaMikdash, which is to always go up in holiness. All right, that's the discussion. But besides that discussion, which it has its own difficulties, the Braita itself is very difficult. It's difficult for several reasons. It's difficult, first of all, because we don't have anywhere, any other place that presents as a legal statement the essential way to do a mitzvah, a better way to do a mitzvah, and the super-duper better way to do a mitzvah. And then to find that there's a machloket, but the machloket is about the super-duper way as opposed to the essential way, is really strange. I mean, that's kind of like saying, okay, you got to make kiddush. We all agree you got to make kiddush. Beit Shammai and Hillel disagree how to make kiddush. They do. What did Beit Shammai say? First you say Mekadesh Shabbat, then you say Berei Pregafen. Beit Hillel says you say Berei Pregafen, Kadesh Shabbat, we pass like Beit Hillel. We all know that. It's a Mishnah Psachim, Mishnah Brachot. We're familiar. You have a Kiddush cup. You have to have a Kiddush cup? Yeah, you have to have a Kiddush cup. Should the Kiddush cup be nice? Yeah, be nice. How about making it really nice? That'd be really good. How about if I make it silver? Ooh, that's really nice. What if I put in the names of my family members? Ooh, that's really nice. Beit Shammai says, put your father's name first. Beit Hillel says, no. You don't have a machloket about how to beautify something. A machloket about the essential halacha. So this whole thing is very strange. The next brightness, skip to the next paragraph. Tana Rabbanan. Ner Chanukah mitzvah lanicha al petach beito mibachutz. Right, the mitzvah is to put the Ner Chanukah where?
Outside.
But where? Outside? Right next to your door on the outside. Good. Im hayad dar ba'aliyah menicha b'chalon ha'smucha l'rishut v'abim. And if you're living in a loft, let's say, where you don't have a doorway, could you go through somebody else's door and get into your house, to the house that you're living in, so you put it in the window that faces Rishut HaRabim. V'uvishata sakana menichal shulchano v'dayo. And when you're in times of danger, you put it on your table. What kind of danger are we talking about? In your table, meaning in the middle of your house. And that's fine. What kind of danger are we talking about? What sort of danger? So Rashi makes an interesting comment. And I'm going to take you to Rashi now. You don't have it on the page. I'll take you to two comments of Rashi here. First one is this. Shata Sakana. Remember, we're reading a Braita. Where are the Braitot composed? In Eretz Yisrael. When are the Braitot composed? Same time as the Mishnah. Which means before the year 200, 220, right? Rashi comments on Shata Sakana, time of danger, and he says that the Persians had a rule in their religion. And the rule was that they had a holiday in the winter, which is a fire holiday. No surprise, everybody's got a fire holiday in the winter. And if anybody had a light lit, a flame going, in their home, on that day they'd come and trash your home. And Rashi even quotes a Gemara later in Shabbat, where I believe it was Rav, was asked, am I allowed to move? This is a muktzah question. Am I allowed to move my lit candle out of the way because those habarim are coming? And this was, by the way, at the age of after the Parthian dynasty was, the Parthian rule was destroyed, and the Sasanians took over, and the Sasanians elevated the Zoroastrian priests to positions of power, and they gave them power in the country, which means they could actually go in and do what they wanted to do. And he answered, yeah, you're allowed to move it, because it's dangerous, because they'll see it, and they'll come and trash your house, give you trouble. Okay, so Rashi says that's what the Shata Sakana is. The only problem with this, of course, is that this Shata Sakana is a totally Persian problem, not an Israeli problem. Meaning, it doesn't belong to Eretz Yisrael, it belongs to Bavel. And it's also 100 years later. It's after, in the 3rd century. It's a problem. We have another problem here, which is, we go back to the word Mahadrin. So you translated, Harold, very accurately, that Mahadrin is to beautify. Right? We use that in modern Hebrew. The only problem is that word just doesn't appear in rabbinic literature, not as a verb. But there is a word like that which is in Aramaic, and that's a word that appears throughout rabbinic literature. Right? And lahadure is in English, in Hebrew is lechazer, which means to search after something, to go after something. So, for instance, the Gemara in Brachot in the 8th parak, talking about Havdalah, says that as far as the Ner and the Besamim go, Ein machazrin alayhen kederach shemachazrin al kol ha-mitzvot. You don't have to run after them. You know? And so then one of the Chachamim said, I used to run after it. Have a mahadrinan. I would run after it. Once I heard that law, then I would say, if it comes to me, fine, and if not, not. If I have a candle, fine. If not, I just make Havdalah without it. And then later on, I make a Havdalah. Right? Okay. That's, by the way, the halacha. If you're making Havdalah and you don't have a candle or access to a candle, you make Havdalah later that night. It's going to be Saturday night, and you make Bar Mirayesh on a candle. Right? So the word lahader, as an Aramaic word, which is very common in rabbinic literature, means to run after something. All right, so the interesting thing is that Rashi's comment on mehadrin in the Gemara is mehadrin achar hamitzvot. So Rashi isn't interpreting it as beautify, but as chasten, which is fine. But suddenly, Rashi seems to be reading this braita and the next braita as being kind of Babylonian and Aramaic, which is why Louis Ginsberg suggested these braitot b'chlal are Babylonian braitot, which itself is a little bit of a difficult statement, but that's part of his approach. The question is, what's going on here? So I just want to take a look at these two braitot, because Moshe Benovitz, in an article that he wrote, not that Moshe Benovitz from NCS Weichel, I think is his cousin, guy I knew him years and years ago in Israel, he's still teaching and writing great stuff, wrote an article in which he used part of Shama Friedman's study of the language of this braita, and he utilized it. I came up with a suggestion that more or less is replicated on the back. And what you're going to find here is that our practice on Hanukkah is really something of a hybrid. They suggested that what you're looking at in this braita is really a composite of two different sources that got melded together in a way that is seamless, so that when everybody reads the braita, they're able to read it without a break. It doesn't seem awkward at all. And yet, that there's two different things going on. Let's see. Tana Rabbanan. Look at the back. Mitzvat Chanukah. And now I'm going to read. This is the way that the Eretz Yisraelic version would be. Mitzvat Chanukah. Beit Shammai Yomrim Yom Rishon Madlik Shmona Mikan Va'elach Pochet Volech Uveit Hel Omrim Yom Rishon Madlik Achat Mikan Va'elach Mosif Volech. In other words, that the Beit Shammai Hillel is not Mahadrin Min Mahadrin. That in Eretz Yisrael, this is what they read. This is how they read it. Meaning, what's the mitzvah of Chanukah? The mitzvah of Chanukah is to have a certain amount of candles and to either diminish or add every night. And it's a machloket, but Shamin Hillel, not about Mahadrin Min Mahadrin. The machloket is about the essential mitzvah. And that's why, first of all, that answers the question, well, how could it be Beit Shammai Hillel disagreeing? They're disagreeing not about a super-duper heater. They're disagreeing about the essential mitzvah. And that's why later on we hear a story in the Gemara, it's quoted in the Gemara, it's in the red here, a story about two chachamim in Sidon. Sidon is a town near Tveria. It's not Sidon, it's Sidon. That one of them practiced like Beit Shammai, the other practiced like Beit Hillel, and when asked why, they gave the reasons which fit in the discussion that we had. What happened in Bavel? It becomes very clear from the sugyot that in Bavel, the only thing that they did was to light one candle. They didn't add every night. They lit one candle. It's very clear because in every Babylonian statement that we have in the Gemara about Ner Chanukah, it is always in the singular Ner Chanukah. Not only that, but something a little bit further. A halakha that we're all familiar with is the halakha of the Shamash. What's the halakha of a Shamash? You can't have just the light of Ner Chanukah. You have to have another light there so that if you're reading or doing something else, you're not benefiting from Ner Chanukah, right? Where does the Ner Shamash start? If you take a look at the halacha, it's actually in the red here. Amar Rava, Sarich Ner Acheret Lishtamesh Le'ora. It starts with Rava. It starts in Bavel. Why does it start in Bavel? I want you to picture this. If you have a single candle outside, you don't need a shamash. You know why you don't need a shamash? Because you're not sitting out there reading. You just have a candle outside your house. When do you need a shamash? What was the halacha just before that? When it's times of danger and you bring it inside the house. You've got a single ner sitting on your table. When you have a single ner sitting on your table for Ner Chanukah, then that's giving you all your light. So you need another candle so that you're not using the Ner Chanukah. However, where are there times of danger? Like Rashi says, it's a Babylonian problem. And how many candles would you have every night of Chanukah? One. That's the Babylonian custom. And therefore, the Shamash becomes vital. What was the practice? So look at the top of the page. Ner Ishu Veito. That's the mitzvah of Chanukah. Veham Mehadrin. Again, Babylonian. The people who really run after mitzvot, what do? Ner l'chol achad v'chad. In Bavel, we have one ner per household, that's it. The people who are super duper frum, the people who run after mitzvot, they have one ner per person.
In Bavel.
One ner per person. And they don't add, meaning if there's three people in the house, every night there's three candles, that's it. So, now they were aware that in Eretz Yisrael, there was a whole different approach. So what did they call it in Bavel? They called them Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin. You know, they're picking off of their own practice and saying, we have people who are Mahadrin. Now our people who are Mahadrin, they light one per person, not per they don't change every night. That's the thing. They light one per person. In Eretz Yisrael, they got a whole other system. So we're going to call them Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin. In Eretz Yisrael, they never called it that because that was their basic practice. And what do? They either one or eight. One up or eight down. Very simple. And then when you take a look at the location, you have a similar thing. Ner Chanukah mitzvah lahanicha. Lahanicha. Now, by the way, what should the word be? What is lahanicha modifying or describing? It's modifying the word ner. Ner is masculine. Masculine. It's one of those words like chalon, which has a feminine suffix, but it's still a masculine word. Chalon gvohim, right? So nerot dolkim, right? The candles are lit, right? In Bavel, the way that they read the way that they read Chanukah, they referred to it as a ner Chanukah. In all of our Eretz Yisrael Decker sources, they refer to it as Chanukah, which means it becomes feminine. So when you say Chanukah mitzvah lahanicha, they call the ner, the candle, Chanukah. So Chanukah mitzvah lahanicha. By the way, in Bavel, as becomes very, very clear from the sugyot, the custom was to put the candle where? On the door of your courtyard. Rav Huna, famous halacha. If you have a courtyard that has two openings, you have to put a ner on each side. The opening like a T. Like an L. Put one here, put one here. not at your doorway, but in the courtyard. In Eretz Yisrael, where was the custom? They put it in front of the door. This is an Eretz Yisrael piece. And then what happens is then there's the Babylonian add-on, which is Uvishata Sakana, you put it on your table. What you end up seeing here is that, and you can see it just in the top section, is you have essentially one breita, which is an Eretz Yisrael Dika breita. It starts out with Mitzvat Chanukah, Beit Shammai Omrim, Bayom Rishon, Malik Shmona, Mikan Ve'elech Pochet Volech, Ve'etel Omrim, Bayom Rishon, Malik Echad, Mikan Ve'elech Pochet Volech. Chanukah, Mitzvah Lanicha, Al Petach Beitom Bachutz, Mayadar Ba'aliyah, Menicha Bachalon, Asmuchalach, L'Rishut Arabim. That's the Eretz Yisrael Dika piece. In Bavel, they got this breita, what they do? They wrote, put an envelope around it. So we have a different approach. What's our approach? Ner Chanukah is how many? We don't go up or down. We have one candle. We have people among us who are very, 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 you know, love mitzvot. So what do? One per person. They light three or five or seven, or how many there's in the household. It's beautiful. And by the way, we have another consideration that they don't have in Eretz Yisrael, which is we can't always put the Ner Chanukah somewhere which is displayed, because we've got these Zoroastrians. So what do we allow? We allow you to put it on the table inside. But if you're going to put it on the table inside, what do you need? Din Shamash. So when we read the Gemara, when you open up the Gemara and say, oh yeah, we all know that sugya, but Shammai Hill, everybody knows that. You read it through, you suddenly realize that you almost can't be reading a single statement. And when you start looking at the other Makorot, you realize that parts of this statement are purely the approach taken in Israel. Part of them are purely the approach taken in Bavel. And what at some point happened early in the development was it became a composite statement. And of course, our practice is really a composite practice. We regard Beit Shammai Hillel as being Mahadrim and Mahadrim, and we all do Beit Hillel, Mahadrim and Mahadrim. We have machloket about how to do it. Do we follow Tosfot, which is only one per household and keep adding every night? Or do we follow the Ramah, in which case everybody has their own Chanukiah and keeps adding every night? We all do Beit Hillel. We all use a shamash, and we use a shamash where? Anywhere. We put a shamash wherever it is. I have this discussion with my wife every year, because you guys know where we light. We light right underneath the porch light outside, on the porch. And there's a huge porch light there. And I just told her last night, I said, we don't need a shamash. She goes, I know, light the shamash. Right? And then, of course, my students say, so what do you do? I said, what do you think I do? That's pshita, right? Because after all, with halacha, if you only have enough money for Ner Chanukah and Ner Shabbat, what do you do? Ner Shabbat because Shlom Bayit, right? Of course, so that trumps all. But an interesting question is, you have enough money for Ner Chanukah and for Ner Shabbat, only for Ner Chanukah or Ner Shabbat, which one do you do? The simple question is, why don't you do both? Meaning, use a Ner for both. The answer is that they have to serve exactly opposite functions. Which is the Ner Shabbat has to sit there and give you light. The Ner Chanukah has to sit there and not give you anything. And just publicize it to the outside world. Which is if for some exigent reason you have to have it on your table, you have to have another Ner. They serve two opposite functions. But in any case, hopefully we got a new take on this very well-known series of Breitot, and saw that it really is reflecting two different traditions which ultimately and fairly early in the process became the composite, became the practice that Am Yisrael practices on Chanukah.